We were startled to read, in a current issue of The New Yorker, an article on Gertrude Stein, which segued into being an article about a dear friend of ours. Leon Katz, who had a strong influence on Gertrude Stein scholarship in this country. Well, it's a peculiar article, which led me to write a letter to The New Yorker pointing out the peculiarities. It profiled Leon as an extremely mysterious individual lurking in the shadows, kind of like Deep Throat. If you do read The New Yorker and are intrigued by this mysterious figure, you might like to tune in to our website and hear our interview with him. We're a bit ahead of The New Yorker in talking with a fascinating and mysterious individual. It's on our website, www.hitching.org. Locate the Listening Room Archives section, program number 26. Check it out.
By the way, remember that you can always, anytime, hear any of our shows on our website, www.hitching.org. Anything from a piece of this show that you missed to any of our shows in the last 3 years of broadcasting. Even at 2 a.m., you can listen if you don't have something more interesting to do.
Journeys toward truth take circuitous paths. Sometimes it's about telling something. Other times it's not about telling the truth, but living a truth. Even trying to center in on what this is all about. You know, am I here to serve God or procreate copiously or create beauty or consume huge quantities of gross national product or spread love? And how do I live that?
This is a story we did a while ago in our Philadelphia phase, and we thought it'd be appropriate to rebroadcast. A life journey toward living one's truth. This is Judy Claude.
Who are the people the media call activists? Did you ever wonder about them? What makes activists so active? What do they do for a good time? In Philadelphia, there's a foundation called Bread and Roses Community Fund. We went there to check out activists.
Bread and Roses has made a commitment to fund those organizations that are working for social change. And by that, we mean that we fund groups who many times are involved in demonstrations and educational activities, advocacy work, etc., to try to change social policy. It really seeks out what we consider to be groups that are usually too radical or too small or too controversial to be funded by traditional foundations. Because most foundations look for a flavor of the day. And, you know, after a certain point, civil liberties and demonstrations were no longer the flavor of the day. So that's really the difference, I think, for Bread and Roses.
What's constantly amazed me in doing interviews is the roundabout road that brought people to wherever they are now. So I asked,
how did I get involved with this? I grew up in West Philly. Made a decision to go south because that's where the action was in 63 when I graduated. And swore to my mother that in my first year of college I would not be involved, would not go to jail, basically. I had to swear on a Bible. And in my second semester I was in jail. So much for that swearing, okay? And eventually dropped out of Fisk in Nashville and spent some time with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and then came back to Philadelphia in 67. Finished at Temple in economics, and then did a lot of work around what was then the Black Power movement, Pan-African movement. Lived in Tanzania for 2 years, and then started working mainly in religious organizations at that point who were still fairly radical to do community organizing work and that kind of stuff. I grew up in a fairly nuclear family, okay? One sister, just she and I, she's older. Mom and dad, my parents divorced in 58, which was very uncommon at that point. But I had a really strong extended family on both sides. So it's like my grandfather, my father's father, came up the summer after my parents divorced and said to my mother, remember, if Chris at some point does not do child support or whatever he's supposed to do, you just let me know. We'll take care of that, right? I think my father lived under this threat all his life, okay? And so I think for my sister and I, there was always I mean, there was security, and there was never a sense of insecurity at all. But my parents also were fairly conscious. So I always tell people this, the earliest thing I remember about television is my mother watching the McCarthy hearings. And I always remember how she said, "They got him, they got him." But none of that meant anything to me, kind of, because, you know, I was like 6, 7, 8, 9. I mean, but it's just there. It's just part of the, you know, river of memory. And I've heard Julian Bond talk about this, too. But the thing that always stayed in my mind was Jet Magazine in 1955 published a picture of Emmett Till in his casket. I can nearly draw that picture. That is the picture that almost everyone I knew who was in SNCC had that image in their mind and still does. And we can still see Emmett Till in his coffin in Jet Magazine. It is with this swollen face. It is an unbelievable thing.
So you're off to college. You've promised your you'll study hard and stay out of trouble. But it's, what, 1963?
Was I scared? We had been picketing this restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee. We had been picketing this restaurant most of the late March, early April of, I guess it was 64. And finally, they moved on us. And the first time the cops moved, the line dispersed. And we literally broke ranks, and we went around the corner, and we had this long discussion because we had not come prepared to go to jail. And then we made a decision, and then we were scared because a lot of us in that particular demonstration were freshmen at Fisk. I mean, our parents were ready to shoot us when they found out. And so we went back and knew that when we went back, we were going to get arrested. And we were arrested, and next thing I know, we are all going to jail, and then our lawyer is going to jail, and then his friend, the other attorney, is going to jail, and then a couple other ministers are going to jail, and I look up, and everybody's going to jail. And I'm like thinking, oh, God, my mother is going to kill me. I mean, that literally was my first reaction. She is going to kill me. They housed us all in one cell, and had to be about 40 to 50 women in one cell, and then decided to intimidate us by housing in the cell with us women who were in there for murder. Except politics create different phenomena, and so the women were fascinated with the fact that we young people were willing to stay in jail. And we stayed for 2 weeks, and I came back to the dorm. And my mother must have had radar, because within 15 minutes after I was in the dorm, the phone rang, and it was my mother. And my mother didn't say hello. She said, "Were you raped?" That was her first question. I said, "No, Mom, but I got lice in my hair." And I said, raped? No. I mean, but that was because she had heard about what had happened to some of the women who had gone to jail in Mississippi and so forth. So that was her first concern. And later when I talked to my father says, "Please don't do this again. This really is not good for me." He says, "Your mother about drove me crazy." Okay. I don't know. I took a bite of the apple, and I've just been nibbling at that fruit ever since. I mean, it's just been a real part of me ever since. And it is interesting to watch what has happened to all of us who came through the civil rights movement, because I think so many of us were able to find places where we could continue to do, quote, good. And yet, we lost a lot of folk. I mean, we lost them either mentally and emotionally, or we lost them physically, okay, because we fail to understand that it's all right to take a vacation or it's all right to have some time to do some reflection. And it took me a long time. I used to think vacations was a bourgeoisie trip. I mean, you know, that you shouldn't do that. I can't wait to go on vacation. Okay, I mean, it's taken me a long time to realize how important that is. And also living overseas enabled me to take a break as well. That was the other thing, to look at the U.S. from a different perspective.
In the 70s, she went to Africa. I never asked her what brought that about. I had the sense it came out of a great need.
Tanzania had a President Nyerere who had offered sanctuary to Afro-Americans who didn't want to go into the war. There was a large Afro-American community in Tanzania. It was also the Dar es Salaam, the capital, was also the site of the OAAU, the OAU's Liberation Committee. So that meant that all the representatives of the liberation forces in Africa were based in Dar es Salaam. And so that whole exchange between Afro-Americans from the United States and the liberation forces from, you know, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, you know, Namibia, etc., that was a very rich and a struggle, too, because we didn't always agree about certain kinds of things. And it was a chance to do some reflection about this country, okay, and about the struggles that I had been involved in up until 74. And so for me personally, it was a healing time. I remember crying for like, I don't know how many days. And the tears were just years of having believed and, you know, rapid social change, and then realizing that change doesn't happen like that. And, you know, by 74, you began to realize that things were going to take a lot longer to change than you thought. And so it was a serious healing process. And I think that was true for a number of Afro-Americans who were living there. There was also a rich intellectual exchange. It was the first time that I really had a chance to really interact and talk with Cubans, because Tanzania had a diplomatic relationship with Cuba. And so it was, you know, unlike here, it was a chance to have that kind of interaction. And at that point, the Chinese were building the railroad from Dar es Salaam to Zambia. I mean, the Chinese grew their own food. They moved, they built encampments as they moved along. They trained people as they went. This is completely different than what, you know, the U.S. or anyone else does when they come into a third world country. And yet they were wrong about certain things. Politically, the Chinese were wrong. I mean, I was not a Maoist, so I was like, they're wrong. We also could see the weaknesses. So the idealism about Africa was stripped from our eyes. But also, there was a real appreciation of the reality of Africa, too. And I remember the Tanzanian family that I was very close to asked me why I was coming back. And I said, well, let me put it to you this way. I miss my tribe. I miss my nuances. I miss the way we talk, the way we walk. I'm going home. Okay. I mean, I never thought I would say that, but I'm going home. And this is home. I mean, I'm an American, whether I like it or not. This is who I am. And when I came back from Africa, I was really clear. This was it. This was home. I mean, we make it here or we don't make it at all.
What I was hearing from her, I think, is that the work of social change didn't just happen outside herself.
But there is something else that has raised my consciousness as well, and that has been to balance with breast cancer. The concept, the idea of having cancer can be a defining experience in terms of enabling a person, and then particularly enabling me, to gain a finer appreciation of every single day. So every day becomes important and precious and a gift. And so you don't care about lying about your age anymore, because you're just so happy you got there. In 1984, when I was diagnosed, I was just 37 years old. I mean, it was a frightening thing. And I remember my husband asking me, are you worried about being, you know, scarred or something? Because we were trying to make a decision about whether I get a mastectomy or a lumpectomy. I said, no, I'm worried about dying. I never even thought about the scarring part at all. Dying is what I was worried about. I mean, it was coming to grips with knowing that you finally don't have control. Okay, I think cancer makes you realize that you're all vulnerable. And particularly if you're control crazy like me, you realize that you're vulnerable no matter what you do. This one is not in your control. And so it really became important for me to begin to let go in terms of control, and also to begin to learn to appreciate every day and realize that it was a gift. I talked about it. That was the other thing that was different, too. Because in my talking about it, I discovered so many other women who had breast cancer, but who never talked about it. And I kept saying, well, what good are you if you don't talk about it? Got to talk about it. Got to talk about it. It's really important that you talk about it. And I also think that it's also been important for me to know that my friends have not treated me any differently because I've had breast cancer. So there's very little sympathy. You know what I mean? It's like they still demand the same things from me. I mean, it's, you know, I can't use excuses or anything like that.
So we came up to the present. Not the best time to be a radical.
Well, you know, I always tell people that you've got to understand history in terms of struggle, that you've got to have a historical perspective on struggle. I can say that at 50 now. So this is a nadir. And what I, for those who are feeling very depressed, I keep saying, but we've been here before as a nation. And that period of time after World War II was the most unique period in U.S. history. I mean, we have not had that kind of economic dominance before. If we've not, you know, this is more like what's the real the U.S. And what, quite frankly, our groups do keeps me going, too. I mean, that I just figure that there are groups like the ones in the Delaware Valley all across the country who are doing things. I got criticisms of them in terms of being maybe too narrow and not thinking more globally, etc. But nonetheless, they're working. And I believe that out of the seeds of their work comes a new movement, and probably be about 2010. Okay, you can quote me on that.
In Philadelphia, we were talking with Judy Claude.
Well, we don't want to set the bar too high. Leave out people who try and don't quite make it. There was a congressman who supported the confirmation of a profoundly unqualified, mediocre judge and said, well, most people are mediocre. They deserve representation, too. And so we would like to give equal time to the journeys toward truth by the frightened, desperate, the very confused.
This is Watchers.
Hun, what's the weather like? Why don't you jog outside?
It's supposed to snow.
Ooh, what if the car doesn't start?
Well, it'd save on gas.
It's a blizzard out there.
Granny, that's the TV.
TV's over there.
No.
Well, I can't see. These glasses, ever since I got these glasses, I can't see.
You can see.
I can't see.
Look, we take care of you. The doctor prescribed those glasses. The doctor knows if you can see.
I couldn't see the doctor.
Is that the Johnsons?
Wish they'd keep their window closed.
It's tic-tac-toe. I'm gonna scooch my chair up closer. Oh, no. It's one of those horrible, violent things. I wish they wouldn't show that.
She's worse than the kids.
Well, she wants to go to a rest home.
Oh, no.
I'm not gonna put my mother in a home. People have to take responsibility.
But she isn't happy here.
She'll be happy whether she likes it or not.
I never seen the like. That poor woman. And what if those children saw that, what they're doing on there?
Granny, that is not the TV. That is a window. That is a woman out there at... Oh, my God.
It's awful what they have on there.
Honey.
What?
They've got that woman and they're... Oh, my God.
Honey.
Right outside our window.
Oh, the window's closed.
We can't let them get away with that. A lot of people stand around and let them get away with that, but we will not stand around and let them get away with that.
We'll take responsibility.
A good idea. We'll call the cops, because the cops have got sophisticated computer communications, and they'll be on the scene in seconds. Now, I'll do the dialing. You get the description. No, you do the dialing. Won't the kids be proud? No, I'll do the dialing.
Call the police.
What's the number?
Find a pencil.
Call the cops. See, the cops, because they can't get away with this. Crime, inflation, radiation.
It's horrible.
H for horrible.
I can't find a pencil.
Is that the girl was on Johnny Carson?
Granny,
I thought she was cute.
That is the window.
Well, I can't see. You're just a big white gob. My only son is a big white gob.
We have to take charge. Some people sit behind their four walls with their family and wait for the blizzard, but when you get the chance to reach out and create positive social change...
I miss Arthur Godfrey.
Dial information. No, they charge for that.
Oh, our phone bill last month.
Get the description. Oh, how many are there?
One, two, three, four... No, she doesn't count.
What'd she look like? They put you on the window.
witness stand, you have to be precise or the defense attorney will rip you to pieces.
I'm trying.
Phone book. 1, 2, 3, 4. She doesn't count, but she does count because she's the human being, and we gotta call it ambulance.
I'm trying.
Fix your hair.
Why?
Your witness, you gotta look neat so they believe
you. I don't have anything to wear.
Phone book. What? Come on, what do they look like?
Oh, there's one black.
Black? He must be underprivileged.
One with a leather jacket. What? He's white.
White. He must be a young punk. One black, one punk. What about the third guy?
What's the commotion?
See for yourself.
I can't see.
No. No, that's right. We're all blind to reality. We don't see the writing on the wall.
I told him not to scribble, but you said the magic marker would wash off and you're the daddy.
No, we look in the paper, look out for number one. We look through our rose-colored glasses right into the teeth of the blizzard.
I could see better with my cataracts.
Come on, the third guy. We gotta see the third guy, because we're not gonna stand around. There he is, there he is, there he is. He hasn't got any clothes on.
They'll know him right away.
That's no description. Look at his moles. They always have moles. Picture
a pencil.
Oh, yes.
Look at his moles.
Call the police. Okay, white, black, no clothes, naked, leather jacket, girl. Operator, give me the police. What?
It's starting to snow. She'll be in the snow. She'll freeze in the snow while we sit in here warm and comfortable, and she'll freeze in the snow. Where's the paper?
Weather report. Find the paper.
Fix your hair.
Find a pencil.
Make a list.
Look at his moles.
Call the police.
Call the police. 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 It's the police. I called the police. I really called the police. Okay. Police. Yeah. Here it is. You get this. White, black, no clothes, naked, leather jacket. Girl! Thank God.
I'm gonna see what else is on.
Are you okay?
Oh, tired. I mean, boy, there were three of them.
I'm so proud of you.
Oh, honey, for once in our life.
But, honey, it makes me think.
Oh, it's good. It's really good.
But why is it that we're more concerned about strangers than about us?
Oh, no, it's for us. It's for us.
All this unbridled energy. When have we felt this way? Together.
Oh, but honey.
We've lost touch. I read the paper, you jog. We yell at the kids. We clean up Granny. How long has it been?
Oh, honey, I hear you calling to me. It's like a sudden fanfare. What right do we have to reach out and meddle in the world until we put our own lives in order? Oh, honey, let's not meddle in other people's lives. Let's meddle in our own.
Things happen for a reason. It's a blessing in disguise.
I wish we could afford cable. I could almost see better without these glasses. I'm just gonna take them right off. There's a dead woman out there.
We'll close the curtains.
I wish they'd have more comedy.
That was Watchers. We were joined by our longtime colleague Camilla Shade as Granny. Our engineer was John Ewell.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by the Independent Eye and is supported entirely by our vegetable garden and you. And that's it.
You know, we don't get any money from the stations. They have their own bills to pay. And so you are hearing what you are hearing because we just can't help doing it. The costs of the program are borne by generous individuals, one of whom you may easily become. Tune into the website, become a member of the Hitchhikers Guild, and keep this menagerie on the air. www.hitching.org.
Next time, a friend who skied across Alaska and other attractions, the adventures of Renette.
And if you're in the North Bay, on the final Friday of each month, we produce a performance party, the Hitchhiker's Cabaret Cauldron, the kind of show that could only happen in western Sonoma County. Schedule on the website, www.hitching.org. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. Peace and joy.
So what happened in the meeting was that Bush not only covered all of those topics, he covered them extremely well and with great intelligence and most amazingly with no notes. No notes, no prompting. At the time, what I concluded was one of two things. Either they're making him out to be stupid and actually he's incredibly brilliant. Or somehow somebody is feeding him electronically or in some other way this information that he was saying. And so at the time I was 50-50. It's like, wow, maybe they're fooling everybody into believing that he's stupid and actually he's quite intelligent. Well, later on I learned that was not the case. That Bush, you know, he's about what they portray him to be.